His father had drilled this work ethic into him. And something else, too. That no one accomplished anything without the help of others. For the past year, Dean had been bugging his superiors at Fort Campbell for a training mission in the Middle East. He campaigned relentlessly. In January 2001, he and his team traveled to Uzbekistan. Dean was fluent in Russian, and the political challenges facing the former Soviet Republic were a heady fit with his omnivorous intellect. He was able to learn from the Uzbekistan army firsthand about the Islamic Militant Union insurgency, and this made him think of terrorism broadly. He started asking his intel sergeant, a tall, taciturn Texan named Darren Klaus, about a group of fundamentalists in Afghanistan called the Taliban, and their enemy, the Northern Alliance. Dean loved parsing the political matrix. Whenever he and the team returned from a trip overseas, Dean posted his findings, pie charts about terror attacks, informal intel summaries about the Taliban, and general musings about geopolitics on a bulletin board in a back hallway at Fort Campbell's 5th Group headquarters. But not many people paid attention. Afghanistan wasn't on anyone's radar. And still, sitting in K2, Dean didn't have a mission. He hadn't given up yet. He was the personification of persistence. Several years earlier, he'd been rear-ended by a drunk at a stoplight and had gotten out of his car to have a talk with the driver. As he approached, the driver sped away. Dean gave chase on foot. He ran alongside the vehicle and managed to wrangle himself up into the passenger window and onto the front seat, whereupon he persuaded the driver to pull over. The driver just looked at him, amazed. Dean ached to do an excellent job as a soldier. Ached. But the higher-ups at K2 in the Pentagon had yet to make a decision. What Dean needed was a warlord eager for American expertise. 100 miles to the south from where Dean now sat in his tent, watching Moulin Rouge on DVD for the 10th time and hating it, the warlord Ustad Atta was meeting with CIA officers and discussing just such a plan. After Dostum's charge up the hill, Nelson and Jones had to turn from the fight and head back to Chobaki to plan the next day's movement of the team. Nelson hated to leave. He stood on the hilltop and watched the Afghans continue fighting, running, and riding toward the village of Chapchal, several miles to the north. The Taliban were in pell-mell retreat. Shouts filled the dusk as they ran. Nelson had to get Sam Diller riding to a village called Oymatan in order to set up bomb strikes on Taliban tanks that Nelson and Dostum were sure would be coming down the valley. And as Diller would leave, Spencer would come in, riding up from the base camp at Dehi. Nelson could hear the eagerness in his voice whenever they talked on the radio. Spencer wanted to see the battlefield. Nelson and Jones rode to the rim of the valley at the trailhead, and they picked their way in the dark with the horses' metal shoes sparking on the rocks. At times they couldn't see anything except a skim of stars overhead, like ice crystals thrown against a black dome. At the bottom of the canyon, Fakir met them. He told Nelson that he admired his courage. They rode in silence to the trailhead, leading up the valley wall. Nelson bobbing in the saddle, exhausted. After 4 hours, they rode back into the outpost at Chobaki, the wind rising off the river with its chalk smell, and the current's hush brushing the canyon's walls. Back in the States, news had finally hit the papers that U.S. Special Forces were in Afghanistan. As Nelson was riding back into camp, Americans logging onto their computers could read a dismal assessment issued by the Center for Defense Information, an independent think tank made up of academics and retired military, about the military's effort. The Northern Alliance advance has been described as stalled, largely because the opposition force is still grossly outnumbered and their transport is unreliable and slow. Afghan opposition troops in the area around Mazar are reportedly almost out of ammunition, food, and medical supplies, which would hamper any attempts to convert U.S. strikes into permanent military gains. Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld called Colonel Mulholland at K2, blistering him with questions. What the hell was going on? Where was the progress? Why weren't more Taliban positions being destroyed? Mulholland didn't have an immediate answer, but he'd get one. When Nelson threw down his rucksack, ready for sleep, one of his teammates nearby stirred and sat up. He said he had a message for Nelson from an intel specialist at K2 who worked as their interface with Colonel Mulholland. The message wanted to know, as Nelson would later say, when are you guys going to get off your ass and do something? Nelson couldn't believe it. How dare the old man question what they were accomplishing? He didn't know where to begin. He walked around the camp, getting angrier by the minute. He thought of going to bed. He needed sleep badly. He decided that he wouldn't respond until morning, with a cooler head. He climbed into his sleeping bag. His mind wandered to his wife, Jean, who was pregnant and working mightily to keep the house going. He'd give anything to tell her about this. This goddamned message. He couldn't get it out of his mind. What did it mean? When are we going to start doing something? Annoyed by his fidgeting, his teammate asked, "Are you going to answer it tonight or go to sleep?" Nelson decided to get up. He drank some water and ate part of an MRE, thinking about all that he had seen these last few days. God damn it all. He'd been fighting his heart out, and meeting the Afghans had nearly broken it. Seeing them, the lame, the scarred, the broken, had touched something in him, deep. Men riding horses into sheets of gunfire. These were men who had nothing, yet they offered him everything, their lives. They would die for him. He wanted to tell the Pentagon that he was doing the best he knew how to do. He set his Panasonic Tough book on his knees and opened it, the screen lighting up his face. He began typing faster and faster. It read in part, "I am advising a man on how to best employ light infantry and horse cavalry in the attack against Taliban T-55s, tanks, mortars, artillery, personnel carriers, and machine guns. A tactic which I think became outdated with the invention of the Gatling gun. The Mujahideen have done this every day we have been on the ground. They have attacked with 10 rounds of ammunition per man, with snipers having less than 100 rounds, little water, and less food. I have observed a PK gunner who walked 10 miles plus to get to the fight, who was proud to show me his artificial right leg from the knee down. We have witnessed the horse cavalry bounding over watch from spur to spur to attack Taliban strong points, the last several kilometers under mortar, artillery, and sniper fire. There is little medical care if injured, only a donkey ride to the aid station, which is a dirt hut. I think the Mujahideen are doing very well with what they have. We could not do what we are doing without the close air support. Everywhere I go, the civilians and Mujahideen soldiers are always telling me they are glad the USA has come. They all speak of their hopes for a better Afghanistan once the Taliban are gone." Finished, he closed the laptop, feeling better. The email would become, in the words of Major General Jeffrey Lambert back at Fort Bragg, the most famous intel report of the war. Several days later, standing before reporters and television cameras at a Pentagon press conference, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld would hold it up and read out portions to the nation. The crowd was moved by the poignancy of this young, anonymous soldier. Nelson's words flew around the newswires. Nightly anchors quoted from it. Nelson had managed to sum up the frustration, fear, and hope among his own men and among the Afghans. That he had written it in a fit of pique when he was tired, hungry, and pissed off would remain his secret. Later that night, Dostum, having also returned to Chobaki, told Nelson that at the very end, the fighting had been at close quarters, the opposing sides as near as 65 feet from each other. "I have never seen the Taliban fight so hard," he said. He shook his head in amazement. He believed the Taliban knew they were losing the war. His men had killed 123 Pakistanis and captured 2. Dostum had lost several of his men. One had taken a grenade, the last one remaining among the entire force, and run into the Taliban lines to blow them up, killing himself. When he heard this, Nelson was upset. He and Jones had carried 8 grenades and returned to Chobaki with them. Nelson was worried that the general had put himself in harm's way. He regretted not staying with him. He realized how protective he had become of the warlord. Back at the Alamo in Dehi, as more wounded Afghan soldiers trailed into camp, Medic Scott Black found himself knee-deep in gore. For the past several days, he had been working frantically to care for both Afghan and Taliban fighters. Black didn't think he'd ever seen a tougher people in his life. Their eyes were full of terror, but they rarely made a sound. These guys, it seemed, could withstand any kind of pain. He was asleep well after midnight, when he was shaken awake. Black woke with a start, looking around the dim room in the fort. He saw before him a middle-aged Afghan man, one of Dostum's soldiers, holding a lantern and looking concerned. "Commander Scott, we need you now. There is emergency." He scrambled out of his sleeping bag and walked in flip-flops, camo pants, and brown t-shirt across the dusty courtyard and out the front gate. Before him sat a parked Nissan pickup, with all its doors flung open. The truck's pale dome light was on. It cast a feeble light on the ghastly scene inside. On the rear seat in the cab of the truck lay a young Afghan boy, maybe only 14, 15 years old, it was hard to tell. He'd been shot in the stomach, and was rolling his head back and forth on the vinyl seat, which was slick with blood. He was opening his mouth to moan, but no sound was coming out. Black saw that he had to act fast. He shot the kid up with morphine, while another boy, maybe 18, who turned out to be his cousin, held his hand. Black stood at the kid's feet. It was as good a place as any to treat him. He probed the wound. It was deep. He felt around inside, trying to find the bleeder, the vein that was gushing. He couldn't feel it with his slippery hands. There were no guts hanging out, so he couldn't examine them for wounds. He guessed an AK-47 round had penetrated the kid's peritoneum, but he couldn't find the hole. The bullet had likely nicked an artery. It was dark in the cab of the pickup, except for the glow of Black's halogen headlamp, and it would be a tough place to do surgery. But Black was pretty sure he was going to have to cut the kid open if he couldn't stop the bleeding. He first tried packing the wound with an absorbent material called Curlex. The idea was to pack it against the wound with your index finger, as if you were stuffing Kleenex down a Coke bottle. Black packed about 2 rolls inside the kid, but the bleeding didn't stop. He'd lost an immense amount of blood, and fresh plasma was something Black didn't have on hand. The kid was quickly slipping out of his control. If he died during the surgery, the Afghans would blame Black for his death. Black knew that, and worried about it. This worry had little to do with medicine, and everything to do with fighting the kind of war he was in, where his relationship with the locals could mean life or death, his own. Black decided there was nothing he could do, short of transferring him back to a hospital in K2, unless he could stop the bleeding with the Curlex. He worked for 2 more hours, packing and repacking the wound, until he reluctantly accepted that the bleeding just wouldn't stop. Blood had splashed all over his feet and his flip-flops. He'd never lost a patient before in the field. In fact, this was his first battlefield casualty in his 6 years in Special Forces. In the tiny compartment of the pickup, he could smell the blood and hear the kid's troubled breathing, and he felt a wave of despair sweep over him. The cousin was still holding the young boy's hand as Black shot him with even more painkillers, and through an interpreter told the cousin that he should take him home to his family. Better to let him die in peace, surrounded by the people he loved. The young man just nodded. Black helped him lift the wounded kid's legs up in a bent position on the seat so they could shut the truck doors. Black stood in the dirt and watched the taillights of the Nissan disappear over the ruts in the road. He was running low on med supplies again, and had ordered an airdrop. This was supposed to come any night now. With the fighting picking up, he realized he had to brace himself for dozens, maybe hundreds more casualties, like the one he'd just treated. It was a daunting thought. He had believed himself to be a pretty hardened customer, but the kid's impending death ate at him. Just a teenager. He walked back to his sleeping bag in the horse stable, and tried to sleep, but couldn't. As Black treated the wounded, Night Stalker pilot Greg Gibson and mission commander John Garfield had taken off from K2 on the resupply mission, bringing in the equipment that Black and the team had requested. Ammo, blankets, winter coats, sterile water, IV sets, rubbing alcohol, latex gloves, nylon sutures, bandages. The glue of war. The tools for healing men. The flight in was terrible. The visibility zero. An hour after taking off, Gibson had flown straight into the gullet of the Black Stratus. The wide slew of fog, snow, and dust, whose existence had mystified weather forecasters at K2. Gibson was flying strictly by cues presented to him on the tiny screens in the dim cockpit. The world outside the windscreen was a depthless white. After 3 hours at the controls, Gibson's nerves were fried. But he had entered a zone where he remained completely in control of the craft and all of his faculties. He completed the majority of the flight without incident, and as he neared the HLZ at Dahe, Gibson handed the controls to his co-pilot, Aaron Smith. They would land, offload the gear, and zoom away, turning around to head back through the lousy weather to K2. As they dropped altitude, Gibson, sitting in the pilot seat with his arms folded, heard a voice from the back of the ship. One of the crew members, standing in the open ramp, was yelling over the intercom, "Pull up! Pull up, damn it!" Gibson waited for Smith to do as he was told. The crew in back provided a second set of eyes and ears for the pilots, who implicitly trusted their directions. But when Smith hadn't corrected course, for whatever reason, Gibson grabbed the stick between his knees and put the aircraft into a serious bank. They were practically tipped on their side, with Gibson staring up at the sky over his left shoulder as they turned. It was then that Gibson saw they had nearly run straight into a mountain. The crew in back was knocked to the deck. One of them, Tom Dingman, had seen the rock face coming at them and had been the one to yell just in time. They had been seconds from hitting it head-on at 90 miles an hour. However, they turned so sharply that the helo's tires hit the mountain wall. the large aircraft bounced as if off a trampoline. They hit so hard that the FLIR, or radar probe, on the nose of the craft was knocked loose. It was hanging now by just heavy wires. As they finished turning, Gibson caught sight of an Afghan man sitting atop a horse on the ridgetop they'd just struck. He was blown backward out of his saddle by turbulence from the rotor blades. Gibson leveled the helicopter out. It was shaking violently. The twin rotors were out of synchronization after the impact. The cabin was shaking so hard that Gibson found it difficult to read the instruments. John Garfield, sitting in the jump seat, got on the intercom. The unit's official motto was, "Night Stalkers don't quit." But Garfield felt they would be pushing the limits of the craft's endurance if they tried to land. He didn't want their epitaph to read, "They just didn't know when to quit." Garfield announced that the conditions were just too hairy. Screw the supply drop. They were returning to K2. Gibson got on the radio and told K2 what had happened. "What's your status?" came the reply. "Well, we just bounced off a mountain," said Gibson, in his cool, southern pilot's voice. "We don't know how bad it is," said Gibson. "It's looking pretty damn bad. When we get things figured out, we'll call you." "Roger that." As they headed into the night, Gibson felt like they were getting beaten to death by the vibrations. They had at least 3 hours of flight time ahead of them. After an hour, Bass called back, wondering how they were making out. "Like I told you," Gibson said, his voice rattling from the violent movement of the aircraft. "We ran into a damn mountain, but I think we're going to be fine." But an hour from the Uzbekistan border, one of the crew looked down through an open door and saw a flash. They were flying about 800 feet above the ground. The flash was followed by a burst of light in the clouds behind the escort helicopter that had been trailing them during the mission. They were under attack by anti-aircraft fire. Gibson saw another flash on the ground. Any moment, he expected the helicopter's defense measures to kick in. These consisted of pods of metallic chaff secreted around the outside of the aircraft, set to go off when in proximity to an incoming missile. The release of the chaff was accompanied by the automatic popping of bright flares on the sides of the craft. These looked like exploding fireworks. The idea was that the heat and mass of these objects would draw incoming heat-seeking missiles away from the helicopter. And that was how the procedure generally worked, just fine. The right gunner reported seeing another flash as a missile climbed from the ground and exploded, but not close enough to set off the flares and chaff on Gibson's helo. Another pilot, Jerry Edwards, who was flying the trailing helicopter, was not so lucky. His helo popped its flares and chaff and illuminated the night sky around it, bathing the aircraft with bright light. Both helos were now clearly visible from the ground. They'd been spotted. Almost immediately, more missiles exploded around them. The pilots put both craft into a serious climb. The excitement was so intense that everyone on Gibson's helo forgot that it was supposed to be shaking itself apart. About half an hour later, they landed safely back at K2. After shutting down the aircraft, Gibson returned to his cot in the abandoned aircraft hangar, eager for sleep. It was nearly dawn. Life as a night stalker had assumed the predictable rhythm of intense periods of boredom, punctuated by sheer terror. Fly all night, deliver supplies or people to different parts of the country, come back to base, debrief, fall asleep. Wake at 1 or 2 in the afternoon, make a big pot of coffee, and wander out back to the veranda, which the Night Stalkers had constructed out of sandbags and wooden packing crates, and outfitted with a barbecue grill. The sandbags kept the prop and rotor blast from hitting the pilots as they sat waking up in their robes and flip-flops, while the rest of camp was already at work, Someone had even planted a small lawn around the decking, which they kept green with the cook's dishwater. They lined the lawn with hand-painted rocks, and somebody stuck in a sign announcing that it was a recent recipient of the Uzbekistan Yard of the Month Award. Jerry Edwards had begun keeping a journal, writing down snippets about life in the air. On one of his recent missions, they'd actually blown a hole through the fog with the Chinook's massive rotors and created a tunnel through which a C-130 fuel tanker was able to safely pass and land. It was wild stuff like that that you had trouble explaining to folks back home. Edwards worried that he wasn't good enough yet as a pilot to keep up with the rest of the crews, the kind of obsessive attention to perfection that in fact made Edwards an A-1 Night Stalker, one of the top 5% of all helo pilots in the U.S. Army. Sometimes after coming back from a mission, he couldn't sleep and walked around the camp trying to wind down. One night he found a cobra in one of the porta-potties that dotted the camp. He dashed backward out the door, slamming it behind him. Returning to his cot in the hangar, he opened his sleeping bag to find two pit vipers inside. He missed his wife. He wondered where in hell all the goodbye sex had gone. Each man got 10 minutes a week to make what the Army called a comfort call. He queued up outside the crude booth with its ancient rotary phone to wait his turn. The line was long, but Edwards was determined to make his call. After an hour of waiting, he was next in line, hunched against the chill in his flight jacket. The guy inside was exceeding his 10-minute allotment and clearly not caring. Edwards knocked on the door and said, "Hey man, we got people out here who need to make a call." The guy, an Air Force officer, ignored him. Edwards saw that there were only enlisted guys in the line. The Air Force dude was pulling rank. Edwards outranked them all. This dickweed needed to be taught a lesson. After 15 minutes, when the man still hadn't hung up, Edwards yelled, "Get off the phone, for everyone's sake!" The door flew open, and the guy started asking Edwards who did he think he was, and what was so important, and so on. And Edwards just stood there, bone tired. What mattered now was talking to his wife. He pushed past and said, "You're all wrong, pal." It was 10 p.m. back in Fort Campbell. His wife answered, and after a couple of long yawns, he figured he was waking her up. He could hear his 3-year-old daughter babbling in the background. After the expected small talk, in which Edwards reminded his wife that he needed toothpaste and handy wipes sent in his next care package, his wife said, "Jerry, I'm pregnant." Edwards was stunned. "Are you sure?" "I've taken 3 tests. And then his daughter got on the phone. "Are you at work, Daddy?" Edwards, still reeling from his wife's news, sputtered, "Yes, sweetie, I'm at work." "Can you come home from work?" "No, not now. I'm going to see Santa." Edwards was suddenly sad he wouldn't be seeing Santa with his daughter. "I love you, Daddy," she cried. "I miss you so much." Then she handed the phone to her mother. "That's great news," said Edwards. "Really great. I'm going to be a father again. Wow." He could barely feel his feet touching the ground. He and Diane talked a few more minutes, and looking at his watch, after exactly 10 minutes, Edwards said he had to go. He hung up. He walked back to the hangar in a daze. "Man, I'm going to have a baby." It was nearly dawn. The guys inside were watching American Pie and laughing their asses off. "We have to make it out of here alive," he thought. The following morning, October 24, Sam Diller left the Chobaki outpost. What he and Nelson had planned the night before was audacious. Diller, along with Medic Bill Bennett and Weapons Sergeant Sean Coffers, planned to ride 20 miles west into the mountains and set themselves on a high vantage point overlooking the Taliban's flank. With them were about 30 Afghan soldiers, Dostum's men. They would commence bombing the tanks and soldiers, rushing down the valley to reinforce the army fighting Nelson. The key to Diller's survival was stealth and speed. They would be deep in Taliban territory. Diller hoped to be resupplied with food and ammo, but that was doubtful. The Air Force demanded 24-hour scheduling notice on drops, and he knew he'd be unable to schedule that far in advance. They'd have to live off the land. There'd be no hope of quick rescue. He swung up into the saddle and looked at the mountains, and then at Nelson. "This has got risk to it," he said. "I know that." "If it goes bad," Diller said, "you won't be hearing from me again." "I'll be seeing you again." Diller had an 8-hour ride ahead. He turned his horse and his men, trailed by several mules hauling their rucksacks. They began riding across the camp and soon disappeared down the hill. Nelson waved and watched them go. As Diller rode away, Spencer and Black at the Alamo rode to Nelson at Chobaki on borrowed horses. This was a social visit of sorts. Each man wanted to leave the confines of the base camp and survey the battlefield at large. Black had packed his medical gear, and Spencer was carrying a radio in case they were able to stay at the Chobaki outpost and run the logistics base from there. Borrowing the horses had been difficult. There was none to spare among the Afghans, and only Dostum's intercession on the Americans' behalf had landed them in the saddle of 2 tired mountain ponies. The ride was exhilarating at first. It seemed to Spencer that every few steps his horse would turn and look at him and say, "You're sure a big bastard. Why don't you get off and walk?" Spencer believed the horse was actually huffing and puffing, as if to be melodramatic. The stirrups were short, and Spencer's knees were practically in his chest. The horse ambled along the rocky path. Spencer's back started to ache. He was wearing his load-bearing vest, crammed with ammo, grenades, water. It weighed about 40 pounds. His M4, which weighed another 7 pounds, was slung across his chest. By the time he got back to Chobaki, his legs were numb. He couldn't move. He sat on the horse, petrified, afraid to get off. He didn't want anyone kidding him about being an old man. At 40, he was one of the oldest guys on the team. Black asked him what was wrong. "Look," said Spencer, out of the corner of his mouth, "I can't get off this horse." Black thought he was joking. Then he saw Spencer wince. "I can't lift my legs. My back is fried. Can you take my foot out of the stirrup?" Black pulled Spencer's right hiking boot from the iron ring and lifted his leg over the horse's rump. Spencer stood gingerly on the foot. He still had his left foot in the other stirrup. He gripped the saddle and pulled the boot away from the ring and set that foot down too. Black could hear him gasp. Spencer stood with his arms over the saddle, catching his breath. "You're gonna have to help me walk, too," he said. "Are you serious?" Spencer put his right arm over Black's shoulder, and they walked a short ways to a corner of the camp. Spencer let out a groan. Black lowered him to the ground. He put a pillow under his legs, and then one under his back. He handed Spencer a pill from his medical kit. "Take this. You should be asleep in about 30 minutes. Spencer woke the next morning after 10 hours of deep sleep. He felt a little better. In fact, he had a herniated disc, but he'd be damned if he would be sidelined by the injury. He struggled to his feet and got to work in the camp. Dillard discovered the horses they were riding didn't mind bullets whizzing overhead. But they hated the boom of Taliban artillery and the roar of American bombs. They bucked and reared when either happened. He found that riding a horse uphill was less bone-jarring than riding it down. He found that a tired horse will kneel and roll over and refuse to move, with a blank, faraway look in its eye. Diller would stand there, hands on hips, feeling sorry for it. The Afghans did not feel sorry. They walked up and beat the animals with stiff whips until the animals rose silently and trudged on. Diller discovered that he was capable of living on nothing but fear, the taste of it tucked like a thin wire at the back of his throat. By the third day of riding the battlefield, he was nearly out of food and low on ammo. They were moving and bombing and moving on quickly. He had begun to feel like a ghost in the mountain. They blew a Taliban ammo dump that caterwauled in the air for 20 minutes after the airstrike. They saddled up and kept riding. They were picking their way across the spine of the Almatak Mountains, through draws and around hills, always nervous they'd be spotted by the Taliban. On this third day, Diller realized they'd ridden beyond the range of any hope for quick reinforcement or rescue. They were true outliers now, men on their own. Diller hunched in his saddle against the cold and spurred the horse on. They were covering ground so quickly, it was difficult for him to schedule supply drops. Diller didn't know where he might be in the next hour. He would be supplied only twice during the 10 days fighting in the mountains. He cut rations among the men to 1 MRE a day. They were in a race to cover ground before exhaustion overcame them all. He was carrying 300 rounds of 5.56 ammo, his M4 rifle fitted with a nightscope, 4 grenades, a 9mm pistol, an extra clip for the pistol, a team radio, and 5 pounds of extra batteries, a satellite radio, 3 MREs in their beige vinyl pouches, a pack of 6 extra MREs stuffed in his pack for emergency, an extra pair of white cotton socks, and a sleeping bag. His mission? Destroy Taliban trucks, tanks, and artillery. And in lieu of actual targets, bomb dirt. Simply make explosions fall from the sky, for psychological effect. If he couldn't kill them, he would scare them shitless. He was doing a good job. Word was coming back over the radio net that the Taliban in Mazar believed some kind of monster now lived in the valley. That monster was Diller. He was intercepting frantic radio calls, speculating on the whereabouts of soldiers who had left Mazar and not returned. The women left behind, their wives, believed they had been eaten by a giant. In the city, when the cold wind knifed from the south, these women could hear a low, dark rumble come up from the valley, the sound of Diller's bombs. The rocky mountain paths they rode along were laden with mines. Moving down the trail was painstaking work. Through the years, some of the mines had been laid by the Afghans and others by the Taliban. Diller would watch as his scouts stopped to tilt their heads and bend down on hands and knees and peer sideways at the earth. Then they would poke around in the dirt and lift the mines from their hiding place, disarm them, blow the dust away, and tuck them in their saddlebags. God damn, but these people are tough. They give new meaning to the word recycle. By the end of the first week, Diller's clothes were hanging off his frame, and he felt like he was sleepwalking in them. He had entered a hyper-aware zone where he felt nothing missed his attention. He was getting by on 2 hours of sleep a night. He wore his boonie cap pulled down over his hollowed eyes, his face smeared with dirt, a few sparse hairs sprouting above his lip. He couldn't grow a beard to save himself. And the mustache, that was a joke. Screw it. He figured he had ways of gaining rapport and the respect of these guys. And that was by being the meanest son of a bitch in the mountain. At night, by the reddish glare of his safety light, he read the tattered copy of Sun Tzu's Art of War he kept in his shirt pocket. The Afghans couldn't read, and they wondered at him as he sat cross-legged on a rock, looking at a page, rubbing his chin, the stub of a pencil gripped between his scarred fingers. All warfare is based on deception. When you are near, make it appear that you are far away. Be swift as the wind, majestic as the forest. In raiding and plundering, move like a thunderbolt. He would then close the book and order the camp to its positions for night security. They were living in caves, small dugouts in rock big enough for several men curled in sleeping bags. In the middle of the packed dirt floor, a place for a fire. And above the fire ring, a hole that had been carved out of the rock to ventilate the smoke. The walls of the caves were charred black by years of fires, and the air inside was rich as a smokehouse's. Diller slept by the door. He did this because he feared attack at night by Taliban, who might come creeping up the mountain. And he feared that his Afghan soldiers might turn him in for the $100,000 ransom offered by the Taliban. That was a lot of money, he knew. Practically more than double what he made working for the U.S. Army. Each night before bed, he set empty water cans with spoons in them outside the cave entrance, which rattled when knocked over. A crude alarm system that he figured might give him several seconds warning he was about to be killed. He fully expected to die. He accepted this with a silent bravado that he didn't talk about with the rest of the team. They already knew. Each day when he left on patrol, he wondered if the Afghans around them had betrayed him. Each moment he felt the impending prick of a knife at the base of his neck. He figured he'd never hear the rifle shot that killed him. After 5 days of sleeping in 2-hour shifts, it was clear nobody was getting enough rest. Diller announced everybody would rack out at night, and they'd take their chances with the Taliban, as well as their own Afghan soldiers. "Boys," he announced, "I'm going on patrol every day, me and 6 Afghans, and they haven't killed me yet. Everybody now gets a good night of sleep." Diller slept near the cave door, because he figured the guy positioned there would be first to get killed in an attack. It was his idea, so he would take responsibility for it. He lay in his filthy sleeping bag, looking up at the vent in the ceiling. He didn't like it. The hole made a perfect place to pitch a grenade into the cave. He looked at the hole, rolled the problem over in his mind, and decided there was nothing to be done. He replayed firefight scenarios in his head if the camp was attacked. He didn't admire the marksmanship of the Taliban or the Afghans. It seemed they had both attended the same pray-and-spray school of automatic rifle fire. So he figured, given a chance, he'd shoot everybody first and duke it out hand-to-hand, grappling, as he had trained to do for hours back at Fort Campbell. Diller was a man supremely aware of his limitations, and thereby immensely confident. That, to him, was the key to guerrilla fighting. He was outnumbered and surrounded 50-1 by Taliban soldiers. They had tanks, artillery, and food. He had the element of surprise. And he was traveling light. They were spidering north along the mountain ridge at 9,000 feet. Mornings were ashen, damp. Deserted colonies of pale clouds raced past their faces and vanished downwind. Diller left on patrol each day after hot tea and a mouthful of flatbread. With his Afghan guides, he probed the trail ahead, crawled under crumbling outcroppings, and lay in the rising sun, glassing the valley below. He was looking for targets, new ones. That was the drill. Back at camp, Bennett and Coffers would call in the strikes on the targets Diller had scanned the day before. Haji Habib's men would then storm the bunkers afterward and make sure everyone was dead. They left no prisoners. They had neither the men nor the means to corral them. And besides, the enemy did not prefer surrender. He could tell when they'd engaged a militant band of Al-Qaeda fighters, fresh graduates, he guessed, from the jihad circuit in Pakistan. He watched from a distance as they blew themselves up with grenades. He would see them evaporate in a fountain of mist, and then hear the dull pop of the grenades carried up the mountain. He admired them, grudgingly. But Diller felt he was tougher. As long as he and his men could eat. After a week, Diller was famished. He was so hungry he had lost his appetite. And then he heard a bell, a slow tolling in the fog one morning. And in the gray mist, he saw an Afghan man herding his sheep. The ragged animals were wearing bells so the herder would not lose them. "Get down there," he ordered Haji Habib, "and get us a sheep." Haji Habib came back minutes later with bad news. They were not for sale. "What do you mean? Who else is he going to sell them to?" "He eats them. They are for his family." Diller walked down the mountain about a quarter mile to deal with a man. He offered $50 for 3 sheep. The herder wanted $500 an animal. Diller was livid. "Who else are you going to sell them to?" he asked again, "at that price." The herder smiled. He had a face like a wrinkled pear. "No one," he said. Diller dug in his bag for money, thousands of dollars in marked bills, so the CIA could follow the trail. Diller had thought it would be months before this money was spent. The nearest, even meager store was 3 days' ride in any direction. Haji Habib and his men slit the throats of the sheep and lashed them on the rumps of their horses and spurred up the mountain to the camp. They skinned the animals and laid the hides in the cold ground and scraped the creamy fat into pans that they set sizzling on the fire. The meat was sliced and laid in the grease and fried. They ate an entire sheep in one sitting. The rest was packed in rolled cloth, with the hope that it would keep in the temperate air. They ate the sheep for the next 2 days. Feeling well fed now, Diller set his mind to the final push. Word crackled over the radio that Dostum was planning a battle for November 5. In preparation, Dean, back at K2, had finally gotten word he was going in. Ustad Atta had agreed to retreat to his stronghold south of Mazar, overlooking the village of Ak Kuprook. The village was about 10 miles to the west of the Alamo, overlooking a river called the Darya Balk. The Taliban had captured Ak Kuprook, and Atta had to retake the town before any Afghan forces could travel north. The two rivers, the Darya Balk and the Darya Suf, converged near a village called Poli Barak. Dostum, with his 2,500 horsemen, and Atta with his 1,000 fighters, would each fight along a wishbone of the two rivers. Dostum and Nelson would move north along the east side of the wishbone, while Dean and Atta moved north along the west side. From Poli Barak, they'd move north along the Darya Balk to take the much larger city of Shulgare. At the same time, 500 fighters commanded by the Hazara warlord Mohakik would protect Dostum's flank in the east. Dostum believed that the town of Shulgare in the central Balkh Valley, was key to gaining control of northern Afghanistan. Once Shulgare fell, Dostum predicted, Mazar would fall, and so would the six northern provinces. All that his forces required to achieve this were sufficient arms, ammunition, and air support. From Shulgare, they'd continue north up the Darya Balkh River Valley to the Tiangi Gap, where the Taliban would likely put up an intense final fight to stop the attack on the ultimate prize, Mazar-e-Sharif, 20 miles to the north. In the midnight hours of October 28, Air Force Staff Sergeants Sonny Tatum and Mick Winehouse, whose arrival Pat Essex had earlier dreaded, lifted off from K2 with Night Stalker Greg Gibson piloting the helicopter. After a 3-hour flight, Gibson spotted the infrared strobe that he supposed marked the landing zone. He set the helo down in an awful dust storm. Swirling out of the dark were suddenly a dozen or so armed men, looking angry, and motioning that they wanted on the bird. This was odd, thought Gibson. Tatum and Winehouse had already pitched their gear off and jumped down. Gibson watched them scramble into the fray. Tatum felt like he had just jumped into a snowdrift. The finely grained sand at his feet was nearly knee-deep. Carrying their 100-pound rucksacks, he and Winehouse had to struggle with each step. The night was bitter cold. The dust burned at the back of his throat. Tatum could see only about 10 feet ahead in the gloom, even through his night-vision goggles. He saw what he thought were Afghan soldiers. They were eagerly waving him in their direction. They were dressed in thin jackets and sandals. Tatum wondered how in hell they were keeping warm. He couldn't understand the language they were speaking, a jumble of tongues. All of the men had guns. Tatum looked around, but he didn't see any horses. He knew that the Americans he was supposed to meet rode horses. But where were they? He looked over at Winehouse, and they both froze. Something was not right. We're in the wrong place, Tatum thought. We're not supposed to be here. Back on the Chinook, Gibson looked out and saw an Afghan waving his arms and hurriedly directing his comrades to board the helo. At this same time, Gibson noticed that what he had thought was the infrared strobe was actually a campfire burning at a far edge of the landing zone. It also dawned on Gibson that they were in trouble. The soldiers had surrounded the aircraft. They weren't shouldering their weapons, but Gibson knew that was only a matter of time, maybe in the next few seconds. Clearly, they expected to get on his aircraft. He was damn sure that wasn't going to happen. On the ground, Tatum was looking around frantically, scanning through his goggles for a white guy. "These guys don't look like gringos," he shouted at Winehouse. "I know," answered Winehouse. About 300 yards away, behind a screen of trees, Nelson and several members of his team stood watching Tatum and Winehouse wander around in the dark. What the hell was going on? Why had they landed there? Didn't they know that place was one of Dostum's prisons, filled with Taliban soldiers? Nelson thought the Air Force guys would get cut down any minute. Behind him sat the infrared strobe, marking the correct landing zone. The pilot must have missed it, must have seen the flickering light of the campfire instead. Now Nelson had a problem on his hands. He and his men had shouldered their weapons and were about to start shooting. Back on the helicopter, Gibson yelled to Tatum and Winehouse that they needed to get the hell on board. The two men couldn't hear him above the roar of the rotors, but they'd already reversed tracks and were churning back through the sand to the helo. Nelson got on the radio and called Gibson. "What are you doing?" "Yeah, we're on the ground," Gibson said, trying to stay cool. "We'll be there in a minute." Nelson and his men stood down. Tatum and Winehouse piled on board, yelling, "There's no white guys here!" As some of the prisoners tried to clamber up the ramp, the Chinook lifted off. Tatum looked down and saw dozens of angry, forlorn faces. Some of the men were shaking their fists at the rising bird. These were Taliban prisoners, local citizens, who were under Dostum's control. He had captured them earlier in the month, before the Americans' arrival. The prisoners had agreed to quit fighting for the Taliban, and in return, Dostum had allowed them to keep their weapons. Some of them even had day jobs as laborers, and returned each night to the mud-walled jail, where they sat around in the freezing dark, bemoaning their fate, but nonetheless alive. They were out of water, food, and medical supplies. When the American helicopter appeared in the night sky, they thought their prayers had been answered. They rushed it because they wanted to be captured by the Americans, whom they were sure would take better care of them. A few minutes later, Tatum and Winehouse landed at Nelson's position. Nelson looked over their gear, shaking his head. They had been instructed to come in with a bare minimum, but each man was toting an enormous rucksack and black nylon kit bags containing miscellaneous items. It was too much gear for them to carry themselves, and there weren't enough horses or mules to do the job. "You'll have to ditch some of that stuff," Nelson told them. He said they'd have to fit everything in one rucksack apiece. "Did you bring any food or water?" he asked. They hadn't. Later, when one of them asked Essex where they might find some water, Essex angrily pointed at a mud puddle and said, "There's what you're drinking, just like everybody else." Over the next 2 days, Winehouse and Tatum set about unpacking and pumping their own water and settling into the team. On October 30, a tall, heavy truck with wooden sides rumbled into camp. In the aftermath of Nelson's bombing, Dostum's men had taken the village of Chapchal. Next, they would attack Baluch, 7 miles farther north. Nelson and his men were moving their landing zone and base upriver to be closer to Dostum's advancing troops. They loaded their gear into the truck, and they climbed a dirt road out of the valley and moved north along the rim. After 10 miles, they stopped. Below them, about 1,000 feet, lay the site of the new base camp. They loaded the gear onto mules and began the climb down along switchbacks into the valley. The river plain was wide and baked hard by sun. Copses of acacia and poplar trees grew in dark green stripes against the mountain wall. They set up camp near the trees. Dostum's tent was a large white canvas affair, stiff as sailcloth, staked out on the ground with manila rope. A cook fire smoldered nearby, upon which sat tea water, murmuring in a kettle. The Americans named the place Helicopter Landing Zone Burrow. Essex and Nelson and the rest of the team lived in caves overlooking the river plain, a half-mile distant. From here, the team would divide and ride out to the battle atop the rim of the valley, spreading in a 10-mile-wide crescent. Essex, Milo, and Winehouse would ride east and north to prevent the Taliban from getting around Dostum's east flank. Dostum and Nelson would form the bottom of the crescent, in the center of the battlefield, with Diller, Bennett, and Coffers stationed on the western point. Spencer and his men would switch in and out of the different cells as the force attacked the approximately 10,000 Taliban troops encamped around Baluch. Nelson and Spencer stood at the cave's entrance and marveled at their situation, which seemed fantastical. They were standing there trying to remove, of all things, their contact lenses from their tired red eyes. It seemed so odd to Spencer to be doing this while standing in a cave. The deployment to Afghanistan had happened so fast that neither of them had gotten the long-delayed laser surgery they wanted to correct their sight.